These are my reflections on Seahenge. With the poem Tump, I did think for quite a while about round barrow or barrow, but the music of the word is part of the meaning, so I stuck with Tump. My life as a viola player was extremely limited. I think there were cries of relief all round when I gave it up. I probably would have been a better musician if my father had not laid so much pressure on me to be a good one. That little museum did have some complete wonders in. I've still got the perfume bottle. It's a Roman perfume bottle. And it's certainly true that I never go anywhere without kicking over molehills and having a careful squint. I wrote these poems at the end of the summer, and I suspect that the idea of roses and then roses beginning to wither and deadheading and so on in our garden had a bearing on the second poem. And what I had in mind here is that all these, at one time, these barrows, hundreds, even thousands of them throughout East Anglia, were once fresh and shapely, and they too wilt. And then they get ploughed in or ploughed over, become sort of deadheaded. The wilderness of the world is a direct quote from Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which he wrote in Bedfordshire, of course, and so that seemed appropriate. Heaven knows how many other people were on these paths. First, the Ridgeway, which goes as far as Ivinghoe Beacon, and then the Pedder's Way. There seem actually to be several Pedder's Ways, but a bit like a kind of estuary or a number of tributaries going to the sea. But the main artery is the one that runs up to Holme, next the sea, or Holme by Sea, in North Norfolk, between Thornham and Old Huntstanton. Poem three is where the voice changes and becomes that of a young woman at Seahenge, and that there were 52, I think, bronze blades wielded by either the Beaker folk or the folk to whom the Beaker folk had given the axes. They'd only come into England from Iberia about 500 years before, primarily into the south and east of England. I aimed in these middle poems for a simpler vocabulary. It's got a number of sort of local words like momets and hodmedods, which are scarecrows, but on the whole, I tried to keep the lexicon that much more simple and also a little bit more alliterative with a song-like property. Usually I see quite a lot of compounds, flame cheeks, twitch fingers, willow daughter, quite a lot of repetition too. The ridge that I refer to in a number of these poems, two or three of them, is somehow a crossing place between inland and anywhere with a sight of the sea. It also seems to be where the dead depart on their way to their sky lives, so that it's appropriate for the dying man. You watched how the ridge grew holy and how the end of the evening shimmered, the bristling fields, copper and bronze. I think he's really watching sunset. But in the poem Tree, I begin to quite deliberately repeat and to indent the repetition, aiming for something like a song-like quality, really, opening over all that is. All that is, white skull. It's almost as if you're entering the mind of the speaker and marvelling together with her. And this poem tries to come to grips with the whole idea that the death of a leader upturns, sort of bouleverse, completely upturns the community. And there's plenty of evidence at Seahenge that the death urns and all the physical belongings of the dead man, or maybe even of the community, were deliberately smashed as a sort of act of identifying with, of sympathy with the dead person. And no doubt the laying of the body in a tree turned upside down, in the cradle of an upturned tree. I think the idea of turning it into a cradle is probably mine. And whoever it is who's speaking to the people in the community is pointing out that you have to observe these rites if you're to hope for a second life. Do this, he said, and he will be sky-born again. And after the fire and flood, you too will be sky-born again. I like the idea of someone coming in from outside, some kind of wise man, along one of the paths and sharing this knowledge. And then we come to the central poem, Altar, the idea of a death cradle again. And the daughter of the dead man takes the lead in actually preparing him, her father, for the funeral rites. But meanwhile, everyone else in the community is on the go. The thing here, of course, is that the present site of Sea Henge is not at all what its builders intended. They thought it would be probably as much as a mile from the foreshore, over dunes and over probably freshwater marsh. And that's why you have the young splashing, delving, squeezing out. They're building a sort of little island, heaping up your island. The posts that were set up side by side in trenches, some of them had honeysuckle rope around them. Extremely strong, apparently. I was careful in ensuring that the references to trees and plants and flowers were all likely to have been flourishing at this time. The sweet water repeated is trying to make the point that this is fresh water, not the salt water that subsequently wrapped itself around Sea Henge. I think I nicked the phrase of darkness knotting inside you from technology of, is it called Technicians of the Sacred? It's a collection of poems, and I had a look at various primitive funeral poems and was very taken with that idea. Those four words, darkness knotting inside you. With seven, suddenly we come back to the first voice again. Is effectively my voice. It simply reinforces this point that the site of Sea Henge is now, or was now, until it was lifted, on a foreshore. And of course there were one or two other likely circles uncovered but left to the sea. And we'd say, well, what could possibly be more appropriate than a place where tide comes and goes? So obviously a crossing place. And if you look at the evidence of other such sites, there would certainly have been quite an elaborate group of circles and walkways and causeways and so on. But that when you're there now on the foreshore, that too, paradoxically, is appropriate. The penultimate poem looks askance at this sort of endless questioning, writing about, asking, debating, and suggests that this is a place where you can, without becoming self-centred about this, can be mindful in setting almost everything aside and just allowing the place to be what it is and to try and identify with it by making an emptiness of oneself and allowing the place to fill it. Wholly to immerse myself, wholly to find myself. And that's really the point at which, even though one's a poet, one has to let go of words.